This episode features discussion of terrorism and animal cruelty that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. February 1983, just outside Dublin, Chief Superintendent James Murphy stood before a swarm of press personnel who crowded him with questions about the missing racehorse, Shergar.
He largely deflected, telling them he didn't know where Shergar was, but that the hunt was on.
He added that they were working with all manner of psychics and clairvoyants to help locate the prized horse. Of course, his use of psychics brought Murphy more ridicule than answers.
But Murphy didn't mind. He had a secret.
He knew that the failed attempt to ransom Shergar in Belfast had been a ruse. That the real captors were in constant contact with police, working with an office in Paris.
As the rest of the world discussed whether Shergar was dead, Murphy and his team were negotiating for his life.
And Murphy had one thing that the captors never expected: insurmountable proof of who had taken the horse and exactly how he could find them.
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. Hostage tells the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and how high-pressure scenarios can affect negotiations.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our final episode on the abduction of Shergar, the beloved Irish racehorse whose 1983 kidnapping launched one of the largest search and recovery missions in Irish history.
Last week, we covered Shergar's short but impressive racing career, which launched him to fame across Ireland in 1981. Following his record-breaking win at the Epsom Derby, Shergar was retired as a stud horse, where trainers would pay up to £80,000 for him to father a foal.
But on February 8, 1983, Shergar was stolen from his stable and held for ransom by a man who went by the alias of King Neptune. From the first day of Shergar's kidnapping, the man in charge of the investigation, Chief Superintendent Murphy, suspected IRA involvement.
This week, we'll examine whether Murphy's hunch panned out to be true and follow the negotiation attempts made for Shergar's life.
In the days that followed Shergar's disappearance on February 8, 1983, a series of phone calls volleyed between the Irish Garda and King Neptune, the man in charge of Shergar's kidnapping.
Per King Neptune's request, a secure phone line to Paris had been established so that Neptune could speak with police without having his calls traced.
But while the Irish Garda were worried about the safe return of Shergar, Chief Superintendent Murphy was asking a different question. Who was King Neptune? As we said last week, Shergar was caught up in a lengthy and violent conflict between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland have been separate countries since 1922, while the majority Catholic Republic of Ireland gained their independence from the United Kingdom. Things were not so cut and dry in the north.
Northern Ireland, up to that point known colloquially as Ulster, was predominantly Protestant and worried that by seceding from the United Kingdom, they were opening themselves up to restricted religious freedom and lack of representation in government. They overwhelmingly voted to remain part of the United Kingdom.
But for the Catholics who lived in Northern Ireland, this meant facing the same oppression and disenfranchisement that the Protestants had so feared.
From this anxiety and resistance sprang up the Irish Republican Army, which quickly became a violent terrorist organization in the 1960s and for the 30 years following. Their goal was to reunite Ulster with the Republic of Ireland and used violence to push their message forward. As happens so often with terrorist groups, those they were trying to protect, the Catholics, turned on them as quickly as the Protestant Irish.
But that didn't stop them from wreaking havoc all over Northern Ireland, specifically in its capital, Belfast, and nearly 2,000 people died in their crosshairs. It was clear that they weren't afraid to add a few more casualties to that list. It was February 10th, 1983. Shergar had been missing for 2 days, and concern for his safety was mounting. The public and police alike were worried that those who had captured the prize horse wouldn't know how to take care of him. After all, Shergar was a stud horse. He would have been accustomed to a steady, nutritious diet, regular exercise, daily pampering, brushing and hoof cleaning, and a gentle touch.
Plus, he would have been more aggressive and likely to act out, as it was stud season and his testosterone levels were much higher than usual. All of this was cause for concern among his regular caregivers.
Stable searches across Ireland had failed to recover the horse, which meant Shergar probably wasn't being kept in a stable. That only added to the panic.
Thompson, Oaksey, and Campling, the three sports journalists who had flown to Belfast to negotiate for Shergar, returned home defeated. They believed Shergar was dead.
And while Superintendent Murphy had his suspicions, the rest of the world watched in silence, living in limbo, unsure whether or not Shergar was still alive.
But remember, Murphy hadn't told the press or public about the mix-up of King Neptune's. As we covered last week, a man who Murphy had assumed to be King Neptune had misled police for almost a day before introducing himself as Arco and saying Shergar was dead.
Then, later that day, the real King Neptune made contact, assured police that the horse was still alive, and gave a nonsensical code word, Kildare 4150, to prove he was the horse's real captor.
The public had no idea, which gave Murphy and King Neptune a cloak of invisibility to negotiate.
That morning, King Neptune placed a call through a French number, demanding £2 million ransom be paid to him that day.
Apparently, King Neptune had abducted Shergar with the understanding that the horse was still owned solely by the Aga Khan. But as we discussed last week, Shergar had essentially gone public. He was now owned by a syndicate comprised of 35 people.
Most of these men were wealthy international businessmen who weren't about to agree to pay Shergar's ransom. They had made back their investment and then some. Trying to get all 35 men to agree to pay ransom was like herding cats.
Cats that lived all over Europe. It was nearly impossible to come to an agreement between them, let alone by the end of the day. On the whole, nobody offered to pay for the horse. What's more, King Neptune had yet to provide proof that Shergar was alive and well. This was the first time in 2 days of negotiating that King Neptune had shown any deficiency as a hostage taker.
The police reminded Neptune that £2 million was a lot of cash. The syndicate wasn't going to fork it over on good faith alone.
King Neptune balked. He sneered. "The horse is fine. Send the money." And hung up.
But if he thought that would inspire the syndicate to act, he was sorely mistaken.
And as the hours rolled by, more and more of the public began to believe that Shergar was dead. Even worse, the syndicate was giving up. When negotiations between Arco and the journalist had broken down, and Murphy had hinted that he wasn't sure Shergar was alive in a press conference, the shareholders wondered if there was still any point in negotiating.
The rumors hit the papers, stating Shergar was dead. With every passing moment, the Garda grew more anxious. February 11th, 1983. Day 3, 63 hours after Shergar's abduction. around 11:30 a.m., the Garda received a phone call from Paris. King Neptune called to tell them that the information in the papers was wrong, that he was going to provide proof that Shergar was still alive.
He instructed the Garda to send someone unassociated with the police and the press to the Crofton Hotel in Dublin. He said to use the name Johnny Logan and pick up an envelope from hotel staff.
The syndicate sent Stan Cosgrove, Shergar's vet and owner of one share in the horse, to the hotel. He was sent to reception and asked for an envelope labeled for Johnny Logan.
It was an odd choice for a code name, as Johnny Logan was the name of a singer who, at the time, was the biggest pop star in Ireland. It's still unclear as to why King Neptune chose this name.
Even more strange, reception had no such envelope for Stan or for Johnny Logan. Unbeknownst to Cosgrove, the hotel was being staked out by the police, and King Neptune had clearly caught on. He hadn't sent a member of his team to make the drop.
While straying slightly from the task at hand, Stan Cosgrove used this misadventure as an opportunity to grab a full Irish breakfast at the hotel before leaving dejected.
Meanwhile, in the Paris office, King Neptune called to berate the Garda for sending so many plainclothes officers to the hotel that morning. He threatened that if any of his men were caught, not only would Neptune kill the horse, but he'd kill everyone connected to the investigation of Shergar.
He hung up. The police believed his threats.
It's important to note that at this point, time was of the absolute essence. Almost 72 hours had passed since Shergar was abducted.
The first 72 hours in any kidnapping or abduction are often the most critical. But according to former FBI negotiator Thomas Strenz, another important aspect of any hostage negotiation is to keep the captors talking. By giving King Neptune control over placing the phone calls and allowing him to speak uninterrupted when he called, regardless of the reason, they were learning about him while allowing him to maintain power. This perception of power kept him calling and feeling like the negotiations were headed somewhere.
A few hours later, King Neptune called again. The police still had no idea who he was, but he had their full attention.
This time, he told them that the proof Shergar was alive was already at the Newry Hotel on Belfast Road in Dublin.
Police raced to the hotel to recover the evidence, and sure enough, an envelope was waiting for them.
They summoned Stan Cosgrove to the police station in Newbridge, County Kildare. There, they showed him the proof. A Polaroid of Shergar's face, with the morning's newspaper in front of it.
But Cosgrove wasn't so quick to believe the photo. It was taken so close up that only Shergar's face was visible in the photograph. The horse's eyes were wide open, but the photo was a little blurry, so it was hard to tell if there was any life in the horse's eyes. It seemed fishy.
But Cosgrove's concerns were of no consequence to King Neptune, who flew into a rage when he found out that Cosgrove was demanding more proof.
King Neptune threatened to kill the horse right then and there if he didn't get the money for Shergar by 9 p.m. that night.
The Garda were forced to tell him that such a feat would be impossible, that the syndicate wanted a photo of Shergar standing up on all fours to prove the horse wasn't dead.
Upset, King Neptune refused. He said that if he didn't get the money by 9, he was killing Shergar. The Garda in Paris begged him to reconsider, but the line went dead.
With no money in hand, the Garda were forced to wait and pray Shergar would make it through the night.
We'll find out Shergar's fate after this.
Now back to the story.
King Neptune had sent police a photograph of Shergar, theoretically taken on February 9, 1983. It was meant to serve as proof that the horse was still alive, but in truth, it was impossible to tell whether the horse was still living in the photograph.
The syndicate wanted better proof that Shergar was still alive. The Paris office kept taking King Neptune's calls in an attempt to string him along and keep him engaging with police. This, according to former FBI negotiator Thomas Strenz, is paramount to any negotiation success. Near constant communication between police and the captors.
The police were still unsure about who they were up against, but Superintendent Murphy had some suspicions. He would have bet money on the IRA, based on the ransom amount and the highly organized abduction tactics used.
Knowing that the IRA was likely involved gave police an advantage, but it also made things much more difficult. The IRA was a terrorist organization, and terrorists are, by nature, much more difficult to negotiate with. According to a study done by Dr. John Horgan, director of the Pennsylvania State University International Center for the Study of Terrorism, most terrorists have a striking number of traits in common.
In general, terrorists are radicalized because they feel disenfranchised and angry and believe they're unable to make change in the current political system. They are underrepresented in their own governments. In the case of the IRA, Catholics were not represented at all. There were no Catholic representatives in the Northern Irish government, so they had no footing in their own country. In the most extreme cases, governments are outright attacking the personal freedom, religion, or safety of a disenfranchised group. And while Catholics weren't under physical attack, the IRA felt ostracized for their beliefs.
Those who become terrorists want to act. They see terrorist groups as crusaders protecting victims of the state. In this way, violence against the state and those who support the state is justified.
Additionally, terrorist groups like the IRA provide a sense of brotherhood and camaraderie. It feels exclusive, almost like a club. This, combined with an extreme sense of justified violence, can make these groups almost cult-like. The Catholics within the IRA were already in the minority, so it was easy for leadership to create an us versus them mentality.
In short, negotiating with a member of the IRA was like screaming into a void. The members of the group have already decided that the police are working against them, so police can't reason with them. This us versus them thinking made it hard for the police to appeal to the IRA's humanity and made negotiations challenging.
But the police persisted nevertheless.
Meanwhile, King Neptune was beginning to sense that Shergar's syndicate and the Aga Khan were stalling for time. But in reality, the British and Irish governments, representing the Aga Khan, a British citizen, and the syndicate, based in Ireland, had discussed the matter at length. They decided that no ransom was to be paid.
Garda in Paris waited by the phone to see who would call first. King Neptune demanding his money, or the Garda in Ireland confirming there wouldn't be any.
But slowly, the media began to speculate that neither the Aga Khan nor the syndicate would agree to pay ransom for the horse, and that even if they would agree, the government would forbid the transfer of ransom funds.
On day 4, February 12, 1983, the police received another call from King Neptune. They answered. Neptune asked, quote, "Are they going to pay the money or not?"
The police answered, "We don't know." This was unacceptable to King Neptune, who said, "That's it then," and hung up the phone. It was the last phone call the Garda ever received from King Neptune.
Now the police, the syndicate, and the general public waited with bated breath to see if, by some miracle, the group holding Shergar hostage would let the horse go instead of killing him.
But as days passed with no sign of Shergar, the Aga Khan and the syndicate had to grapple with reality. Shergar was likely dead. It seemed too maniacal to fathom. Shergar was a defenseless animal, Even the police said they couldn't imagine an Irish person actually killing the horse.
But Shergar never surfaced. To this day, the public is puzzled over why the IRA didn't release Shergar or sell him to a breeder. Killing him seems so senseless, an utter waste.
But for Superintendent Murphy, the case was far from over. A week after Shergar's disappearance, he visited Ballymeny Stud Farm yet again to sweep the premises for clues.
It was at this juncture that he found something that had so far been overlooked. An ammunition magazine discharged in the yard near the stable.
The magazine came from an automatic rifle. The ammo was an exact match for ammunition typically used by the IRA. This all but confirmed Murphy's suspicions. The IRA had pulled off the heist. Shergar had been their prisoner.
But this circumstantial evidence was not enough to bring a guilty party to court.
The IRA had dozens of members, but who was King Neptune? Murphy was concerned that they would never truly find out, that nobody would ever be brought to justice for Shergar's abduction.
Meanwhile, months passed without signs of Shergar. By the end of 1983, insurance companies began paying the shareholders for the loss of Shergar.
Except for one shareholder, who was very displeased to discover that his insurance company was refusing to pay out based on a slimy loophole.
Stan Cosgrove, Shergar's vet, and the man who had attempted to retrieve evidence from the Crofton Hotel, was out of luck. His insurance company was stating that they would only pay out on a dead animal, not a missing one. And as Shergar's body had never been recovered, he could not be listed as dead.
This enraged Cosgrove and permanently embittered him toward Shergar and the entire ordeal. To this day, he won't talk about the horse, still upset about the considerable sum of money he lost. Around £250,000, to be exact.
Months turned to years, and the case went cold. Shergar was never found. Cosgrove has never gotten his payout, and Superintendent Murphy was never able to finger anyone specific for the crime.
The IRA continued to deny their involvement in the case, but in the 1990s, light was finally shed on who King Neptune may have been.
Around that time, an IRA informant by the name of Sean O'Callaghan began working with police. O'Callaghan was a high-ranking IRA operative who shot and killed a Northern Ireland police officer at age 19.
O'Callaghan had joined the IRA at age 15, following in his father's footsteps. Throughout his career with the IRA, he participated in over 70 robberies and attacks on British forces in Northern Ireland. He also inadvertently killed a civilian named Eva Martin in 1974, something for which he has never been able to forgive himself.
But the breaking point came for him in 1975, when a fellow IRA soldier killed an innocent Protestant woman and remarked, quote, "I hope she was pregnant, so I got two prods for the price of one."
That was when he left Ireland for London and started a cleaning business with his wife. But knowing he was respected and trusted within the IRA, the British police enlisted O'Callaghan as an informant, and he re-upped with the IRA in 1976.
Soon after, he met the man that he says killed Shergar, Kevin Mallon.
Although details on Mallon's personal life are sparse, his career with the IRA was illustrious. He was a prominent member known for being violent, forceful, aggressive, and fiercely loyal.
In 1957, a teenage Mallon killed a police officer in County Tyrone using a booby trap bomb and faced the gallows for the murder in 1958. He was found not guilty for the murder, but was sentenced to 14 years in prison for arms dealing and conspiracy.
For whatever reason, he was released from prison in 1963 and went back to the IRA. In 1973, he was arrested and convicted of IRA membership in the Irish Republic and sentenced to another year in prison.
But in October 1973, 28 days after entering jail, Mallon escaped prison in Dublin. That day, IRA gunmen hijacked a helicopter and flew it to the prison, where they helped Mallon break out of the yard and fly away into hiding.
Irish police caught Mallon after 50 days on the lam in December 1973. He was awarded an additional 4 years for his escape attempt.
But bars could never hold Kevin Mallon. In the early months of 1974, he and 18 other prisoners began planning an escape from Portlaoise prison in the Irish Republic.
The prison guards discovered their first attempt at freedom, an 80-foot tunnel that was winding its way outside the prison. But Mallon was undeterred. He and his comrades quickly pivoted plans.
In mid-August 1974, Mallon and 18 other prisoners overpowered guards in the main cell block and climbed onto the lower roof of the building. From there, they hightailed it across prison grounds as the jailbreak alarm sounded.
Realizing that 19 members of the IRA were dashing across the prison lawn, the guards opened fire on the escapees, who had made it to the edge of the prison grounds.
The prisoners placed two explosive devices on the wall and blew it to smithereens. It's unclear how they got the explosives, but there's no question that they were effective. From the yard, they dashed through the woods and onto the road just beyond, where they were able to hotwire cars and escape.
He was recaptured in January of the following year and given 10 additional years on top of the time he already owed. At this rate, Mallon would be in prison until he was an old man.
However, Mallon didn't serve his full sentence. He was released from prison in 1982. The year before Shergar went missing.
According to Sean O'Callaghan, the informant, Mallon was the ringleader in the Shergar kidnapping case.
O'Callaghan explained, Mallon came up with the idea to kidnap Shergar while loafing around in prison. He had been a horse bookie, or someone who takes bets on horse races, before he had gone to prison.
Which meant that Mallon knew a prize horse when he saw it. But Mallon wasn't just in it for the money.
As we discussed last week, at the time, the operating cost of the IRA was roughly £2 million a year. That was a lot of money, and somebody was responsible for earning it.
Sean O'Callaghan was at an IRA meeting in Middleton in 1982. Wherein IRA leadership were complaining that the southern faction of the IRA wasn't providing the organization with enough funds to keep their operation stable.
They knew that in order to raise the needed money, they were going to have to get very creative. But then, as though through divine intervention, Kevin Mallon was released from prison.
The IRA knew he was the man for the job. The organization tasked Mallon with raising several million pounds in funds for their movement.
This was fine by Mallon, who already had some ideas as to how he could raise the money. One such idea was a string of kidnappings that he felt could rake in ransom money.
Senior IRA leadership liked the plan and put Mallon in charge of a new branch of the IRA, Special Operations.
Shortly after Mallon was put on this detail, O'Callaghan remembers reaching out to the Southern IRA faction in an attempt to contact Jerry Fitzgerald, who led the group.
But he quickly discovered that Fitzgerald was no longer in charge, and indeed, there was no longer a Southern IRA. A policeman familiar with the IRA movements at the time confirmed that in early 1983, a small gang of IRA members near Dublin dramatically changed their behaviors, like they were ramping up to something.
Then in February, Mallon's team reappeared. O'Callaghan pieced the two together quickly, but no hard evidence ever surfaced, and they were unable to bring charges against the kidnappers.
As for Shergar, O'Callaghan confirmed that there was no proof, but based on what he'd heard, Shortly after being abducted, the horse went crazy and injured itself. Its leg was broken. Knowing that nobody would pay for a broken racehorse and unable to calm the animal, they put it down only a few hours after its capture.
Rumor within the IRA said that Shergar hadn't even made it through the night. An horrific end to such a beloved creature.
But for the people of Ireland, the nightmare was only just beginning. Because Shergar had never been ransomed, Malin still needed money, which meant they needed to kidnap again. And shortly after killing Shergar, they hatched a new plan to settle the score.
We'll hear the fate of the terrorists who killed Shergar in a moment.
Now back to the story.
According to O'Callaghan, in the months following Kevin Mallon's failed attempt to ransom Shergar, he and his IRA gang began plotting another kidnapping with much higher stakes.
In August 1983, 6 months after Shergar's capture and apparent death, the gang planned to kidnap a millionaire businessman by the name of W. Galen Weston. He was president of a Canadian-based supermarket empire and the vice president of the upscale London department store Fortnum and Mason. Needless to say, the 42-year-old was worth a hefty ransom.
Late that night, the gang of IRA members pulled down the driveway to Weston's estate, armed and ready for what they assumed would be an easy kidnapping.
But instead, they were immediately confronted by Irish police, who were quick to return fire on the criminals.
Realizing they'd been duped, the IRA fought to the death, sending bullets flying in every direction as the police closed in.
Ultimately, Kevin Mallon, Jerry Fitzgerald, and four other key IRA operatives were captured. Some were killed in the shootout.
Luckily, the police had gotten wise and warned the Weston family about the suspected kidnapping attempt weeks in advance. On police suggestion, Galen Weston had taken his family to England to wait out the kidnapping attempt.
Mallon was shocked to learn that the man they had been attempting to kidnap wasn't even home. Police had parked a car in the estate driveway to trick the IRA into believing the family was home. Then they set the ambush.
Those on the police force who handled IRA cases largely agreed that since the kidnapping attempt resembled the kidnapping of Shergar so closely, it was almost certain that the two kidnappings were related.
In both cases, a gang of masked gunmen had stormed the premises in two separate cars and divided into teams that would watch the front of the house and kidnap the mark.
And the ammunition found at the stud farm matched that of the ammunition the IRA had on them the day of the Weston shootout.
After the arrest, O'Callaghan was able to help the Garda piece together the events of the spring of 83. He confirmed that these men were the former IRA Southern Command turned bandits for Mallon.
He also confirmed that Mallon would have trusted these men greatly, and if Fitzgerald was part of the gang, that would have been seen as a crucial mission. He was a high-ranking member of the IRA. His safety was not going to be threatened for just any reason.
And finally, O'Callaghan reconfirmed that a few weeks prior to the Weston kidnapping attempt, Jerry Fitzgerald had confided in O'Callaghan that they had, indeed, killed Shergar a few hours after stealing him.
Despite being a somewhat brilliant criminal, Mallon had made three mistakes that ended up being fatal for Shergar.
First, Mallon thought that the horse was owned by the Aga Khan alone, and didn't realize what a production it would be to secure ransom from all 35 shareholders, Aga Khan included.
Second, he misjudged how much people would care about a missing horse. To him, it was just a single horse. Nobody would care but the horse's owner. But he vastly underestimated how endeared Shergar had become to the Irish people.
People had fallen in love with Shergar's lolling tongue and lackadaisical canter. He was beloved worldwide. Mallon had wanted a quick, quiet operation. He never expected the international attention the kidnapping garnered or the 70-person task force the police put together to locate the horse.
And finally, Mallon underestimated the temperament of a stud in heat. He had no idea how riled up the horse would get, and nobody in the gang knew how to calm him.
There was one last thing that O'Callaghan was able to confirm. After the kidnapping, three groups were established within the gang, and they quickly split, each with their separate orders.
The man, known as Arco, was sent back to Dublin, where he began to make a series of phone calls that would create a distraction. Mallon wanted all media attention off him while he and the horse got away.
Arco worked on getting three sports journalists to Belfast. Arco was also responsible for creating false ransom requests and calling random breeders near Belfast to confuse police and create a wonky trail of breadcrumbs.
Meanwhile, Shergar was hidden away in a secluded area of Northern Ireland, where they believe he's probably buried to this day.
And finally, Mallon hid out north of Belfast, responsible for securing the ransom money. It's unclear as to whether King Neptune was Mallon himself. In fact, O'Callaghan doubts it, but King Neptune surely worked under Mallon's direction.
Of course, this is all technically hearsay, as there is no cold hard proof to levy against Kevin Mallon and the Southern Command. It's highly unlikely that anybody will ever be brought to justice for the murder of Shergar.
And unfortunately, that also means that poor Stan Cosgrove will likely never receive his payout.
The heart-wrenching end of Shergar is part of a larger picture. Like with so many terrorist groups that we cover on the show, their violence and criminal activity often stems from anger, a feeling that they've been wronged.
The IRA wreaked havoc in Northern Ireland for 30 years and still occasionally pop up to this day. They believe that they are entitled to reunite with their Catholic brethren in the Republic of Ireland and throw out British rule.
Their tactics were brutal and inexcusable. They killed 1,800 British personnel and Irish civilians in the 30-year conflict, colloquially called the Troubles. Shergar was just one of the many casualties.
Today, a statue of Shergar stands at the Aga Khan Stud Farm in Ireland, where he still raises and trains future racehorse champions.
Shergar's most notable descendant was a thoroughbred named Othal, who went on to win at the highest levels in both Ireland and Australia. In that way, Shergar's descendants went on to fulfill a legacy that was robbed from him.
But no horse has captured the public's imagination like Shergar, the record-breaking stallion who met a grisly end far too soon. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review. We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Aaron Land and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.